From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Soledad Santiago has been a journalist, a homeless single mother, and a press officer for the state of New York. She's seen the extremes of city life and now writes about them in her novels. We'll talk with her on today's Fresh Air. Also today, we talk with actor Gary Busey about his starring role in the Buddy Holly story, his exhausting fight scene with Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon, and the motorcycle accident that nearly killed him. Elvis Presley was born 57 years ago today. Rock historian Ed Ward shows what made Presley an original. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says President Bush is up and about and is preparing to resume his schedule for the final day of his state visit to Japan. Fitzwater says there's no indication that President Bush has anything other than the flu. Doctors have said that the stomach virus, coupled with fatigue and jet lag, caused the president's collapse during a state dinner last night, Tokyo time. NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
White House officials say despite his illness, the president is expected to keep almost a full schedule on Thursday, his last full day in Japan. He will not attend a planned breakfast with U.S. and Japanese business executives. However, he will hold a second day of talks with Prime Minister Keiichi Miyazawa and then conduct a joint press conference in the afternoon. Thursday was meant to be the highlight of his Asian tour. Mr. Bush and Prime Minister Miyazawa were expected to announce an action plan aimed at reducing the $41 million U.S. trade deficit with Japan. U.S. and Japanese officials were reportedly ensconced in bitter negotiations until late tonight, trying to work out a compromise on a plan to boost auto sales to Japan. I'm Deborah Wong in Tokyo.
The environmental group Greenpeace said today that the U.S.-led bombing of civilian infrastructure in Iraq led to the deaths of as many as 90,000 civilians after the end of the Persian Gulf War. The analysis was made by William Arkin, Greenpeace's director of military research, after a fact-finding trip in Iraq. Arkin said that the bombing of infrastructure had relatively little effect on Saddam Hussein's military capability, but that it took a high toll on the civilian population. He said most of the deaths resulted from the destruction of Iraq's electrical system. The Pentagon repeated today that the bombing campaign included extraordinary measures to minimize civilian casualties. The National Transportation Safety Board is looking into why an engine fell off a Delta Airlines jet yesterday at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Marla Crockett with member station KERA reports.
Investigators with the NTSB began checking the Boeing 737 aircraft yesterday following its emergency landing 11 minutes after takeoff. Results of their inquiry aren't expected for weeks, even months, but speculation is centering on the engine's bolts. At least two other Wright engines have fallen off 737s while in flight, and since 1988, the FAA has required operators of the aircraft to periodically check the bolts holding the engine to the wing. The Delta plane was about 500 feet off the ground when its right engine fell to a taxiway below. 39 passengers were on board the flight headed for Houston. No one was injured. For National Public Radio, this is Marla Crockett in Dallas.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about a point to close at 3,203.94. Advances led declines by a margin of 10 to 7 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Hospital officials in Mount Pleasant, Texas, said today that 21 people were injured in a fire at a chicken processing plant. Hundreds of people were evacuated from the plant after the fire broke out on the processing line. Authorities said that most of the injuries were from minor burns and smoke inhalation, but that a few injuries came when people were trampled during the evacuation. The local fire chief said that the building's fire control system put out the blaze. In September, 25 people died and more than 50 were injured when a fire broke out at a chicken processing plant in Hamlet, North Carolina. The owner of that plant, Imperial Food Products, was fined more than $800,000 for safety violations. Public schools in the nation's 25 largest cities have become racially segregated during the past 20 years, according to a study released today by the National School Boards Association. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Large city school districts today are racially segregated because more minorities, especially blacks and Latinos, live in large metropolitan areas. But Dr. Gary Orfield, a Harvard University professor who co-authored today's report, says no one's been hurt more by this racial clustering than Latinos.
Hispanic segregation has been increasing steadily since 1968, and there are some signs of very extreme isolation developing in some of the largest cities.
Orfield says racially isolated schools usually get less funding and more ill-prepared teachers. In the case of Latinos, this has meant lower academic achievement and an extraordinary 40% dropout rate. Today's report blasted the federal government, the courts, and the Reagan and Bush administrations for abandoning the goal of integrated schools. It called for a national commission to investigate the segregation of Latino schoolchildren and for government-mandated integration in suburban school systems across the country. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton gained endorsement today from 75 state and political and business leaders in Oklahoma. Oklahoma's primary takes place on March 10th. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Soledad Santiago, says she has experienced the extremes of life in New York City, from being homeless to sitting at conference tables at the highest level of state government. Santiago is a journalist who has written about the urban poor. In 1980, she created a Latin supplement for the Village Voice. For a while, she crossed over to work for the government as deputy press secretary to New York's attorney general and head of the city press office for the state's controller. Now she's been writing about the extremes of city life in her fiction. Her second novel, Room 9, has just been published. It's a crime story about corruption in City Hall. Santiago started writing fiction after she figured out she wasn't going to get any further in state government.
I found myself terribly frustrated that I was so close to the power, but I had no power. Given my background and my own personal struggles, I was often disappointed that government was so removed from people's actual needs when I saw that there was so much potential to actually make people's lives better.
How did you end up writing fiction?
That was where I could put the most truth.
Now, I think a lot of people would assume from hearing your name, Soledad Santiago, that you're Latina. But you're not really, so I'm going to ask you to describe how you got your name.
Okay, that's kind of was a rather long evolution. My mother is Swiss and my father Turkish, and I came to this country when I was 12 years old. We moved then to Princeton, New Jersey, to the first planned interracial community in that. It's a university town. And I was bussed in along with the other kids. There was a black family, a family from India, a family from South America. So my identification when I arrived in this country was sort of immediately on that side of the fence. I came to New York during the 60s and married a Puerto Rican nationalist. And I began my writing while I was married to him. And I took the name Soledad, if you remember George Jackson and the Soledad brothers. I was very moved by his writing. He was a young man who had made some mistakes as a teenager and wound up being in prison for life as a result. And I was young myself, and I was able to see, although I'm a pacifist and I don't think I'll ever change that, I was able to see how from his position he wouldn't be able to see any other solution than to bring the entire system down. And I felt his pain. I guess I was had myself been sort of an eternal outsider. And so I took that name in honor of him and of the struggle that he represented to me at that time. And I felt in later years that it would be wrong for me to throw that away because it was and is a part of me.
You've written a lot about Latino issues. You've even edited a publication called Latin New York. I wonder how you felt about doing all of that Latino work but not really being Latino yourself.
Well, that's a really interesting question for me because I think that in the Puerto Rican community, and I think this probably happens also to many women in marriage is that to some extent they take on the husband's identity. And for me, it was a particularly comfortable identity because I had never really belonged in any group. As a Turk in Germany and Switzerland, you were very much an outsider. Then I came to Canada and I spoke German, and it was not that long after the war, and that wasn't very well liked. In the Puerto Rican community, it was the first time in my life, and I guess also partly because of the way I look and I learned the language, that I could blend and be allowed to fit. I have two children that are half Puerto Rican, a very great love for that culture and community.
You sent us a short biographical statement that you'd written up to accompany the book, and it seems like you've had such an interesting life. Now, you were saying that when your family moved to the States, you moved into a planned integrated community just outside of Princeton. But apparently when you were 16, your parents sent you back to Europe because you had become a discipline problem.
Right.
What were you doing that was such a problem to them?
Well, I guess I was becoming American. I mean, my father, even though he became a Unitarian, he was born a Muslim. And the idea of my dating or going to school dances or shaving my armpits, these were things that, and I'm the oldest in my family. So I think it was traumatic. And I also, I think I just got nasty because I didn't fit in my own mind. I didn't think I could fit in Princeton. And Princeton High School is a very good school academically, and I had been to so many schools. And so I think, like many people, even in the Puerto Rican community, the idea is you send the person back to the place of origin. I couldn't go back to Turkey. Even my own father couldn't go back to Turkey for political reasons. But that life would be slower there and that I would be slowed down. And in essence, they were right about that. But, of course, what happened was that I couldn't fit in there again either. And first of all, my language skills were not up to gymnasium, which is the level before university. So things got really worse for me, in a sense. And I then went to Italy and worked as an au pair, and I was kind of happy there.
When you were sent back to Germany, who was taking care of you?
My mother's sister. My mother's one of three sisters, one married a Turk, one married an Italian, and one married a German. And I was actually traded. One of my cousins came over for a year. And his family, he became a filmmaker, a radical filmmaker in Berlin, and his family attributes that to the fact of his year in America. You know, that ruined him.
So how did you get back to the States?
It was after President Kennedy was shot, and I was profoundly affected by that, as was my family. I mean, my father's whole dream in life was to come to America. He even put his birthday on the 4th of July because he wasn't exactly sure in the small village where he came from when his birthday was, but he knew it was around that time of year. And he had come from a village that if you went there today, I mean, I went there recently, it's like going back to the time of the Bible, and he was the only one that got out and got an education. And he wanted me to come home and get an education. To him, that was the way to have a future. And even though I had only done 3 years of high school, I had been a good student, I had enough credits to get into NYU. My father actually applied for me. I mean, he was, I guess, in some sense, old school, and got me. All of a sudden, I had a scholarship to NYU, so I had to come back.
Did you find it any easier to fit into the States when you came back a little older after your stay in Europe?
Well, interestingly enough, when I came back to the States, I went to Weinstein Dormitory in the village, and I had never been exposed to anything like New York City. And there you are, down there in the village, the cusp of late 60s, early 70s. I got right in with everything other than the academics. I was kind of chubby in those days when that was great in Italy. You know, they kept saying, manja, manja. But in the United States, I couldn't get a date. So, and those are the things that are kind of more important at that age. So it was, again, difficult. I mean, it was kind of a long, hard trek, and I'm sure in many ways it made it harder for myself because I didn't know how to help myself back then. I mean, nowadays, you know, we would say, okay, we'll go for some counseling, talk this thing through. But back then, that was it was not something that was in my family's frame of reference.
My guest is journalist and novelist Soledad Santiago. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Soledad Santiago, and she's a journalist, a novelist, and also a former deputy press secretary to New York's Attorney General and former head of the New York City Press Office for the New York State Comptroller. She's written a new suspense novel, which is called Room 9. Let's skip ahead a little bit in your life story. You had married a Puerto Rican journalist, and then you headed an anti-narcotics program. You did some theater work. At age 30, you divorced. And you ended up briefly homeless. How did you end up homeless?
Well, the divorce was extremely traumatic, and we'd never had a lot of money in the first place. But suddenly I found myself without any money. I had made a stupid move, and I guess, you know, that's why I identify so much with people who wind up in this situation. The breakup was so traumatic that I left the apartment. I said, you keep it. He, of course, wound up leaving and going with his new partner, and I wound up in a furnished room. I had to separate my children at that point while I was trying to find work. And this is one of the things that I think is still going on today. At that point, I tried to get public assistance, and the system actually is—it's a system in which you have to fight your way through, rather than it reaching its hand towards you. It lets you fall down first, and so I was told, "Well, come back when you have nothing." I was told that the furnished room that I lived in did not qualify because there was a bathroom in the hallway, and so that I could not continue living there if I received public assistance. So they essentially waited until I had nothing and I was thrown out of that room. And then they said, okay, now we'll help you in the Martinique Hotel, which even then, which was the beginning sort of the wave of homelessness that has grown ever since. Even then, that was a nightmare.
That's basically an SRO, Martinique?
It was the era when they were taking actual hotels that really weren't quite making it and using them to house the homeless. The justification being, and it still is kind of the justification, that federal monies only allow you to pay for temporary shelter. They don't allow you. You, for example, you can pay $3,000 a week for a hotel, but you can't give a family a reasonable deposit on an apartment.
Oh, in other words, so you could put them up in temporary shelter, but you can't help them toward a permanent home.
Right.
So what year was this?
Let's see, my son was about 2, and he's 16 now, so 14 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I'd like to emphasize about that is that I was able to solve my situation rather quickly, and I didn't suffer that long. But I think it's because I did have the tools of very much a middle-class background. And I think if you don't have those tools, if you can't fight the system in order to get what the system is supposed to give you, you're in a lot of trouble. And I think that's the situation most homeless mothers find themselves in.
How long were you homeless?
It wasn't very long. I mean, I think we were in that hotel for a week or two, and then I had been fighting for about a year to get a wonderful apartment in a Section 8 building where Manhattan Plaza, where you had to be in the performing arts to live there. And I went before the committee and I fought my way through because I had written a play and some children's television. And I asserted that gave me the right to say that I was in the performing arts. And I won that. And again, I mean, it was because I knew how to fight.
Right, and because you had some credits.
Right,
that
right.
You had a resume that you could point to.
Exactly, you know, and I knew how to, you know, I was doing some freelance work at NBC during this time, and I'd walked to NBC because I didn't have car fare. You know, I would make my calls in search of, you know, saving my family from NBC or wherever I was working at the time.
So I'm interested in what it was like inside the Martinique. Would you just physically describe the room
yeah.
and the floor that you were in?
It was a hotel sort of very close to Macy's. It was right in Herald Square. Ironically, sort of in the shopping center of New York City. And it was a nice old hotel and had been at some point, I'm sure, a nice hotel with a very big lobby. The particular room that we had faced right out onto the square. It was a small room, you know, with a bed and some rodents. I had to keep my son close to me because they would come out at night in droves. I mean, you could watch the mice play. You could also see the rodents on the window ledges, like the bigger rodents.
You mean like rats?
Yeah. the really frightening part was that it was really impossible to really lock your door. And that was the scariest part.
Who ruled inside the hotel?
Well, I mean, I wasn't long enough to be subjected to who ruled, but I would imagine from journalism that I've done later, and from we also wound up living diagonally across from the Holland Hotel for many years, and went in there a few times. My son was so curious, he wanted to see what it was like. And I think the way that it works is that the children are very much on their own because the adults are just struggling and not making it in a lot of ways. The children form gangs in order to survive, even though they're very young. You'll see 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds traveling in small gangs. And, it's the tough who rule.
You wrote an article, an op-ed piece for New York Newsday about, and this was after you were homeless, but this was an article about how your son came home from school one day and said that he had been attacked by a gang of kids who lived in one of the homeless shelters. And now he felt that he needed some kind of weapon or some kind of protection.
Right.
But I was wondering how you felt about living near a homeless shelter. I'd imagine you'd be very ambivalent about it on the one hand as someone who...
Very ambivalent.
Who really supports homeless rights. You'd really want shelters and good places for people to live. On the other hand, you realize the kind of lawlessness and crime that sometimes comes out of the shelters. And
right. Well, now we were on the other side of the fence, and we were living in what is essentially a luxury building with a playground for the children. And across from us was this hellhole. And so the children that live in the hellhole would try to, you know, come and get a bicycle or the things that they didn't have. And yes, I felt very ambivalent because now I felt my own child threatened. And, you know, he's angry and hurt. And so you find yourself put in the position of trying to explain to your child that, look, this could have been you. And at the same time, you can't condone, you know, the violence, and you can't put your child in the position of saying you got to go out there and fight for your life every day on the way to school.
So how was the situation resolved when your son wanted protection?
Well, we had a huge argument. He thought that he was going to be protecting himself by carrying a Swiss Army knife in his sock. And, I mean, I have lived enough of the street life to be able to tell him that he would be worse off if he had a weapon that he really didn't know how to use. And I explained to him that although he's strong and he has integrity, that he cannot compete in terms of viciousness with somebody who was raised on crumbs and had to fight for those crumbs from the time they were an infant.
So did it get anything?
So, well, I'm sure he snuck his weapons now and then anyway. And he had, I mean, it was a long, frightening time. And then I must admit, when I sold my first book, I took that money and I did what I guess a lot of people would call cop out. I put my son into a private school outside of New York City because I felt that that was not a battle I could wage.
With the battle of having him facing knives and guns on the way to school every day?
Yeah, and just the pull and the romance of the streets also. First of all, you're dealing in a situation when you're it's all right in the lower grades. You can make it through. But when your child reaches junior high school, you're now dealing with a situation where even to bump into somebody in the hallway at school is dangerous because it can provoke violence. So there's that element. There's also the fact that as I said before, a teenager is searching for identity. Now, here they are growing up in the middle of all this hypocrisy. And whatever else we say, you know, the life of the Stoops and the music and smoking a little reefer is appealing. Why wouldn't it be? I mean, what else are we really showing them? This is where they can get to play grown-up.
When you sent your son to a private school outside the city, were you reminded of the days when your parents sent you to Europe?
It was a hard time. I mean, it was a lot of tears on both sides and a lot of explaining, look, I'm doing this because I love you. I'm doing this because I want you to have a future. I'm doing this because right now I don't know any other way to do it. And he's 16 now, and I have to say that it really has worked because he is the kind of young man, and I think, you know, most kids are like this, who is very affected by his environment. And he's now in an environment where academic competition and sports competition is valued. See, that wasn't valued in the environment that he was in before. Other things were valued, you know, like how tough can you be? How early can you have sex? So now he has, like me, a foot in both worlds.
Let me change the subject completely here and get back to your novel, Room 9. There are, you know, in the novel, the assistant to the mayor, a woman, has this very passionate romance with a journalist who's covering scandal within the city, and it's kind of a conflict of interest, but they're having this romance anyways. And you write some pretty torrid sex scenes between them. I'm wondering if that was your idea or if your editor said, you've got to get that kind of stuff in here.
I think we say, have I ever had torrid sex?
No, yes. Have you ever had torrid sex? Yeah.
No, I mean, it's funny, you do raise an issue because my first novel, Undercover, was a story of a woman police officer who was in a lot of trouble trying to work her way out of it, and there was no sex at all. And in the rewrite, I wound up putting some sex in, and I almost had to do it in flashback because it didn't kind of fit into the present. And I found it's one of the most difficult things to write. It was a conscious choice on my part to pick a plot in which the sexual and the political are so intimately intertwined. I also think that in real life, that is how it works, that there is pillow talk, that people who are very busy and who work very hard don't meet a lot of people in other fields, so they do wind up having their intimate relationships in the same circles, and it's not always politically the wisest move. And I also wanted to explore that theme of a woman finally beginning to experience her own sexuality, and yet it coming in this very kind of dangerous, almost tortured situation, because I think that's the case for a lot of women today.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Soledad Santiago's new novel is called Room 9. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. People still talk about Gary Busey's first starring role in the movie The Buddy Holly Story. And people still remember the seemingly endless fight he had with Mel Gibson at the end of Lethal Weapon. Coming up, we talk with Gary Busey about his roles and about the motorcycle accident which almost killed him. Elvis Presley would have been 57 years old today. Our rock historian Ed Ward remembers the King with some records that show why he was unique. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A White House spokesman says that President Bush is up and about after a decent night's sleep. Mr. Bush collapsed at a state dinner in Tokyo, and spokesman said that he was suffering from stomach flu. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says that flu has been a common occurrence during the presidential trip to the Far East.
The doctors are certain that there is no other illness or any other problems related to this, that it's a simple case of the flu. The president's human, he gets sick, and I would refer you to last night's pool report that said half the press corps has been sick with the flu since we left.
Fitzwater would not go into detail about any medical test given Mr. Bush after he became ill. He said that the president planned to keep his one-on-one meeting with the Japanese prime minister, but that some of his schedule will be picked up by other top U.S. officials. The Associated Press, quoting sources close to Virginia Governor Douglas Wilder, say that Wilder will get out of the presidential race. The wire service quotes the sources as saying that Wilder will make his announcement after giving his State of the State address tonight in Richmond. The U.S. Labor Department has given the state of North Carolina 90 days to improve its worker safety program or risk having the federal government take over that program. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
The Labor Department began investigating the North Carolina program after the September fire at a chicken processing plant in the state killed 25 people. State officials admitted they never had inspected the plant for fire code violations, mainly because of understaffing in the state inspection program. Labor Secretary Lynn Martin says that understaffing program is one of many the state must solve, or else the federal government will take over North Carolina's worker safety plan.
Our obligation under the law is to examine state plans to keep them to a standard. North Carolina's plan and the tragedy that happened will not be in vain.
North Carolina Labor Commissioner John Brooks issued a written statement saying the federal report contains blatant errors. He's confident he'll be able to maintain control of the worker safety program. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
And a fire broke out at a chicken processing plant in Texas this morning, injuring more than 20 people. Officials say that hundreds of people were evacuated from the plant at Mount Pleasant, Texas, and some were apparently trampled while fleeing. The fire broke out on a chicken processing line, and a local fire official said the building's fire control system put out the blaze. In Poland, the Solidarity Trade Union has called for a nationwide one-hour strike to protest rising energy prices. Despite a plea from the government, union national leaders voted on a strike on Monday in protest of rising energy prices. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point to close at 3,203. This is NPR News. One day after a European Community helicopter was shot down, Yugoslavia's defense minister has resigned. All five EC truce observers in the chopper were killed when it was shot down by a federal warplane. The former defense minister has supported efforts to send UN peacekeepers to Yugoslavia to end the civil war in Croatia. There have been signs in recent weeks of a division within the Federal Army between hardliners opposed to ending the fighting and those who back peace efforts. According to a former East German political dissident, Stasi, or the East German police, tried to ruin his health by infecting him with a laboratory virus. Deidre Berger has details.
After reading his nearly 3,000-page secret police file, Heinz Eggert says Stasi purposefully infected him with a rare virus. Eggert says the information explains the mysterious illness he contracted in the early 1980s that caused serious depression. Furthermore, the file showed the hospital tried to give him medicine to keep him permanently disabled on instructions from Stasi, and the head doctor reported directly to secret police agents. Eggert, who is now the interior minister of the state of Saxony, says he also learned from the documents that Stasi agents were responsible for causing a near car accident during a drive to Dresden. Last week, the German government opened the Stasi archives to public access. Tens of thousands of Germans have applied to look at their files. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
And a government official in Czechoslovakia has turned down conditions set by Mercedes-Benz for a joint venture with a Czech firm. Earlier this week, officials of the firm said that they planned a project in which the German company would have a stake of 31% after investing $230 million. This agreement has to have Czech government approval. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
Hold it! I want to get one thing straight here. I don't work on January the 8th, because that's Elvis's birthday.
That was Gary Busey in the 1983 movie DC Cab. While Elvis would have been 57 years old today, coming up, Ed Ward pays tribute to Presley's originality. But first, we put Gary Busey to work. Hollywood movies about rock and roll legends are more often than not disappointing. But when Gary Busey starred in the Buddy Holly story, his performance captured something of Holly's originality and energy. It was Busey's first starring role, and it earned him Academy Award and Golden Globe nominations, as well as Best Actor of the Year from the National Society of Film Critics. He went on to star with Robbie Robertson of The Band in Carney and with country music star Willie Nelson in Barbarossa. His most commercially successful film was Lethal Weapon, in which he played the nearly invincible villain Mr. Joshua. His latest role was as an undercover cop in Point Break. I spoke with him last year when Point Break was released. Busey grew up in Texas and Oklahoma. He played football, he played rock and roll, but he also performed in musicals like Bye Bye Birdie and South Pacific. Football and Bye Bye Birdie seem pretty far apart, so I figured he must have had at least two different sets of friends.
No, not at all. It was just football was the thing to do in the 50s and 60s when I grew up in Oklahoma. And my dad was an All-American football player in high school and went to the University of Arkansas on an athletic scholarship. And in high school, when I grew up, there were three kind of guys. There were the social giants, the guys who were good with women and who had cars and who had the Madras shirts and who wore English leather. I didn't have that, and I didn't consider myself good-looking. I had a big silver tooth and a mouthful of braces. I looked like a Corvette coming at you on Friday night. So I wasn't a social giant. The second guys, they were the hoods. They were the car bugs. They were the guys with tattoos. They made their own gang fight weapons. They wore their hair in ducktails. And they did things to women in phone booths that I didn't know quite what that meant. So I wasn't the hood. The third guy was the jock, the athlete. That's where I have this immense amount of energy that I was given at birth. So I put it into athletics. And I became a football player. Well, I love to tell stories, and I love to be funny, and I love to express my energy. So therefore, I got into plays like South Pacific, like Bye Bye Birdie. I would be playing spring football in college and then go over and study Shakespeare at night and do A Midsummer Night's Dream. So it seems like an unlikely partnership, but it worked very well for me. It works very well still today.
Now, I was thumbing through one of these bios of you in contemporary theater, film, and TV, and there was a little quote in this short bio, and it said, "I was the last actor to die in Gunsmoke." You were on the very last episode of the series?
Yeah, that was the last one they showed in March after 18 years, and they picked my show to run, myself and John Beck. And it's funny, it was the story of a Bronco buster who broke the spirit of the horse, and as he was riding in the corral, the horse threw him. He got his foot caught in the stirrup, and he smashed his head against a fence post, and he died of a head injury. And since it was the last show, John Mantley, the producer of the show, came out and said, "Gary, we want you to have something to take home with you as a remembrance of being the last man to die on Gunsmoke." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "It's this." And he gave me the bench that sat in front of the Long Branch Saloon for 18 years.
No kidding. You have that?
I have that in my home, yeah.
Now, the first role I saw you in was in the Buddy Holly story. You starred as Buddy Holly. It was a terrific performance. I really enjoyed the movie. And I remember when the movie came out, reading a story about how you were discovered by the casting agent.
Well, Joy Selznick I met when I did the movie Last American Hero, where Jeff Bridges and I were brothers. And Joyce got on my side and started moving me in a managerial way, although she was a casting person. The Buddy Holly, there was a movie called Not Fade Away that was cast by Joyce 3 years before the Buddy Holly story. Not Fade Away, those people didn't have the rights to use Buddy Holly's name. So we got canceled.
What part did you have in Not Fade Away?
J.I. Allison, the drummer. So I lived with J.I. Allison for 6 months, and I heard every story about Buddy Holly there was to hear from his best friend's mouth, J.I. Well, our movie got canceled. 3 years later, the guys from Philadelphia, Freddie Bauer, Eddie Cohen, and the director, Steve Rash, from Texas, came to town. They found Joyce Selznick because they knew Joyce knew where all the Buddy Hollies were. Joyce said, "There's one guy to play this part." They said, "Who?" She said, "Gary Busey." They said, "Yeah, but he's big and he's blonde and he's not right." And Joyce said, "You must see him." "But yeah, but we got to see all these other people first." "Fine." So Joyce called me and said, "Come on in and see these people." I said, "Oh, come on. You can't make a movie about Buddy Holly. This guy is so special and they're going to do it to playback." And she said, "No, they want to find an actor to sing. It's going to be the first musical done live." I said, "What? They're going to find somebody to sing like Buddy Holly? That's stupid. They can't do that." "Well, Gary, would you please do me a favor and get in here and meet these people?" I said, "Okay." So I walked in, and I weighed 175 pounds. I was in the middle of the surfing movie, Big Wednesday. And every story they started telling me about Buddy Holly, I stopped them and said, "No, that's not the way it goes." And then I would verify the truth of it. And I said, "Guys, I'm double parked. I wish you well on your movie. I got to go." Whoop, and I was gone. The next day, they asked me to come in and sing. And I didn't have any lyrics, and they didn't have any lyrics, so I made up nonsense syllables to "It Doesn't Matter Anymore" and "Maybe Baby," and I got the job.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Gary Busey. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Gary Busey is my guest. Let me ask you about your role in Lethal Weapon. And in this movie, you were the real tough-as-nails villain. There's a fight scene at the end between you and Mel Gibson, and this is just a hand-to-hand combat kind of scene. And the fight goes on for a really long time.
Yeah.
And it would be humanly impossible for any person to take as much punishment as you're administering to each other. Did the fight ever get to seem almost funny and absurd after a certain point? You must have been shooting it a really long time.
We shot the fight 5 nights from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. Mel and I trained for 6 weeks, 1.5 hours a day with 4 martial artists to choreograph it. Bobby Bass choreographed the fight. The martial artists choreographed the moves. Mel and I went full speed with each other at 20-second intervals, and we did it for 5 nights. And it was the most, it's one of the scariest things I've done. But and one funny thing, Mel and I never hit each other, but we came within micro inches of our faces, and we were going full speed. So we're very proud of that. And it was something we were doing in November. And it's very cold in Burbank in November, especially with those raindrops hitting you. They aren't raindrops. It's water coming out of a fire hydrant. They're about 3 inches long and about a half inch wide. And they're hitting you like bullets. And Mel and I would have to lay down in our marks, and we'd just hold on to each other, shivering until action, and then we'd go full speed. And we'd hold, he had a great method of, we'd take a tablespoon of blackstrap molasses and hold it in our mouth for 2 minutes, and then swallow it, and then tap on our temples real fast and take 25 vitamins. That was like every 3 hours. And that kept from the middle of your chest up to the top of your head warm.
Did you catch a cold or anything afterwards?
No. No. It's amazing. I think everyone else did, but we didn't, and we were the ones sopping wet going full-speed combat.
Huh. I want to ask you about the motorcycle accident that you were in.
Good. I'm glad you are.
It was, what, late 87 or 88?
December 4th, 1988, I hit the concrete going 45 miles an hour without a helmet. And when I came out of the hospital, the California Motorcycle Association got me in front of the press and said, listen, go up there and say, you know, helmets are okay, but you believe in pro-choice. You believe in pro-choice, and helmets aren't necessary. You like to feel the wind in your hair and the rain in your face, and you like to see the sun and smell the nature, smell the trees. Go say that to the press. And I'm going, okay, fine. Well, I was still in recovery at that time. I wasn't quite in sync in my brain, and I was going through a form of dyslexia. And also, the helmets, I didn't like them at that time. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, couldn't feel the wind, and it was a blocking aspect. So I said no to helmets. Well, my girlfriend, Belinda Bauer, she was on my back about this. She said, what are you doing? You just almost knocked your brains out on the concrete, and here you're saying you don't believe in helmets. I'm saying, I'm believing in pro-choice. I think you can wear your helmet or not wear your helmet. She said, Gary, look at all the children that are looking up to you. Look at all the people that, that sent you cards and mail and flowers and letters and love. And I said, yeah, I know, but finally, I had a premonition. I said to myself, when I was flying back from New York to L.A. with Belinda, I said, I just had a feeling. She said, what? I said, I had a feeling I got a letter. And it said, Dear Gary, Johnny loved you. He loved Lethal Weapon. He loved Buddy Holly. He loved Insignificance. He loved DC Cab. He loved everything you did. It is this, that, that, blah, 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 blah. And like you, Johnny didn't wear a helmet. And we're sorry to tell you Johnny's dead. And I said, my gosh, what am I doing? I don't want to get that letter. So I changed my stance. Now I'm backing the mandatory helmet law. They wear helmets when they play football. They wear helmets when they ride bicycles. They wear helmets when they steeplechase. They wear helmets when they go into construction zones. You get on a motorcycle and go 85 miles an hour down the road and you don't wear a helmet, there's only one word that that equates to, and that's stupidity. So therefore, the helmet issue is very, very, very strong in my course of action these days.
What do you remember of the accident?
Nothing. I don't remember 4 weeks of my life.
Oh, really? The 4 weeks after the accident, you don't remember? You had temporary amnesia.
Mm-hmm. No, I had temporary unconsciousness. I had complete unconsciousness. I mean, I wasn't out. I was up and moving and around. They kept journals on me. I know what I did, which is pretty silly, but they kept the journals, and I can read those and see what I did. I can see the vision of what I did by reading the words. I had temporary amnesia from, like, January the 8th to the end of January, when I was just kind of vague and foggy on everything.
How did you get your memory back?
I don't know. It just seemed like I woke up on January the 8th and I had a burr haircut in my pajamas walking around and going, what's going on? What happened? Said, you were in a motorcycle wreck. Oh, yeah? Oh, really? Oh, wow. What? I had no idea what had happened to me. I don't remember. Didn't remember.
Were you aware of your memory slowly coming back? Did it suddenly come back all at once? What was that?
No, it was a slow process. It's a very slow process. They say you go through four stations in a head trauma that's severe. The first one's agitation. That's when I would throw nurses 10 feet through the air because I didn't want them touching me. The second one is denial, where you're saying, I'm fine, let me go home, I want out of here. The third one is depression, where you go, whoa, what happened? Oh, my gosh. The fourth one is acceptance. And I didn't get to acceptance until April 15th the following year, and that was Easter. That was the day of the Christian resurrection of Jesus. And I realized what it is like to come back from the dead. So I was going, wow. So that's when I started accepting what I went through, and that's when I started externally healing with a conscious mind.
Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Actor Gary Busey, this is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the president's health?
Well, we'll be hearing from Deborah Wong, who has been following the Bush trip throughout Asia, and we'll be hearing about the president's health, which appears to be all right, according to his spokesman, suffering from gastroenteritis. He gave quite a fright to the assembled diners in Japan when he collapsed at the dinner table hosted by Prime Minister Miyazawa. Also, we'll be hearing in a report about the Surfer Hotline, full of all sorts of new technical terms that surfers use when they call up to find out what surfing conditions are like.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Elvis Presley was born 57 years ago today. He died on August 17, 1977. And between those dates, Elvis Presley became the king of rock and roll. But not everyone thinks he's worthy of the crown. His detractors say that he did little more than copy black styles. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward thinks it's time to come to the king's defense.
Elvis Presley conspicuously lacked a number of qualities that would have made him a personal hero of mine. But just the same, the spate of Elvis bashing over the past year has got me a little upset. Whether it comes from a pseudo-intellectual like Albert Goldman or a sincere but ill-informed source like Public Enemy's Chuck D, distortion of the facts doesn't do anybody any good. The root of these complaints is fairly predictable, that Elvis, a stupid white Southern racist, stole the songs that made him famous, note for note, from the black originals. It makes a good story, shocking, true to the stereotype Northern urban people have of Southerners, but like so many good stories, it's just not true. Lend an ear here and see what you think.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right.
Everybody knows the story of how Elvis, after several half-hearted attempts to record some songs one night at Sun Records, launched into the Arthur Big Boy Crudup song, That's All Right Mama, and sent Sun's owner, Sam Phillips, running out of the control booth yelling at him not to stop. What Phillips, who knew the original, was hearing was a complete and total metamorphosis of the source material. It's a subtle metamorphosis, but it's real.
Well, now that's all right, no mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, no mama. Any way you do, but that's all right. That's all right. That's all right now, mama. Any way you do. Well, my mama, she done told me. Papa told me, too. The life you live in, son, now women be the death for you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right now, mama. Any way you do. Yeah, man.
Elvis has taken the swing from the rhythm, added attention that Crudup's version never had, and he's completely revamped the vocal line. After the runaway success of this first record, Phillips encouraged Elvis to record more black performers' songs. Elvis, possessed of a fine record collection, and with plenty of experience hearing these performers live, didn't need to be pushed. Why, one of his all-time favorite records was on the same label he was.
Oh, train I ride, 16 coaches long.
Parker's Mystery Train is a spooky, mysterious record, just slow enough to be sad, just fast enough to make you realize that Junior isn't going to catch up to this train, which might be death itself. Once again, Elvis heard it his way.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend.
The song is stiffer, more driven, and, again, more tense. Elvis is supposed to have invented the musical style known as rockabilly, the fusion of rhythm and blues and country styles that helped define rock and roll. Without stepping into that melee, let me just say that he did record the archetypal rockabilly song, and, again, it was one he got from somewhere else.
A pink Cadillac, but don't you be nobody's fool. And now, baby, come back, baby, come.
The opening seconds of this record defined rockabilly, whether they invented it or not.
You may go to college, may go to school. Get religion, baby, don't you be nobody's fool. Now, baby, come back, baby, come back, baby, I wanna play house with you. Well, listen, let me tell you, baby, what I'm talking about. Come on back to me and little girl so we can play some house. Now, baby, come back, baby, I wanna play house with you.
Arthur Hard Rock Gutter was a mirror image of Elvis in that he was a black Nashville cat who sometimes recorded blues-influenced country-type stuff. Whatever, Baby Let's Play House in Gutter's hands is no less wonderful than Elvis's version, but it's nowhere near as hopped up. Curiously, the record most of the ignorant critics point to is Elvis's first hit for RCA, Hound Dog. I can't believe any of them have ever heard Willie Mae Thornton's original.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Two different songs, if you ask me. I have, however, uncovered one outright theft, albeit a legal one. Elvis's first movie was set after the Civil War, and although there isn't much music in it, one song, credited to Elvis Presley and one V. Mattson, is performed that gives the film its title. Love Me Tender was known to many as Aura Lee, a song from Civil War days by George Poulton of Cincinnati, written in 1861 before the advent of copyright. But sorry, Chuck D, although I'm not sure, my guess is that Poulton was white. Whether that makes it right, of course, is another matter.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The movie Bugsy may have you wondering if the notorious gangster was anything close to Warren Beatty's portrayal of him. Or whose performance was closer to the real Meyer Lansky, Ben Kingsley's in Bugsy, or Lee Strasberg's in Godfather 2? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Lacey, author of a new book about Meyer Lansky and his times. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.